This is Book Public from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. On this episode, I speak to Patrick Strickland about his story collection, A History of Heartache. In these stories set in North Texas, boys have to grow up fast, and men are haunted by things they can't control. There are fathers and sons here, and mothers. Sometimes they are single mothers who can't always keep an eye on things at home. There's a grittiness here, but also a tenderness. We find the characters looking back on mistakes they've made in life as part of this history of heartache that they can't rewrite or even reimagine. And yet, what they experience and go through isn't so far removed from us. As the author explains in the interview, we all go through life thinking that if we could change just one thing, everything would be better. But is life really ever that easy for any of us? Comparisons between Patrick Strickland and Breeze DJ Pancake and Dennis Johnson are not overstated. Fans of these authors, their spare prose, their clear-eyed storytelling, their subjects of sorrow and loss, but also of grace, will know that Patrick Strickland, an award-winning journalist and writer of nonfiction, is a fiction writer who is here to stay. I spoke to Patrick Strickland about his story collection, A History of Heartache. The idea of A History of Heartache, this is the title of the collection. There's a line in the book, too. There's a story called A History of Heartache, too. But there are echoes of this in the book, the idea of a history. And for me, it kind of points back almost to your work in the nonfiction realm as a journalist, as a writer of nonfiction books. So I wonder if you can talk about this idea of history. And I'll tell you where this comes from for me is this idea about short stories being opposite of novels for some people who want to read long works, big works, ginormous things, and maybe don't give enough attention to stories. And I always feel like, no, stories are these small human moments set against the backdrop of something happening that's going to be history. You know, it's a smaller moment, a smaller story against this bigger backdrop. And I don't know exactly what I'm asking you about, but it just seems to me that as a journalist and a writer of nonfiction books, I'm interested in the idea that you write short stories.
Yeah. Well, just on that note of history and the way that that's kind of played into my own thinking, like in doing journalism, you know, I mean, for about 16 years now, I've covered mostly, you know, conflict in the Middle East. I lived in Palestine for 4 years. I lived in Lebanon for a while. And then from 2015 on, I was covering, you know, what was called then the refugee crisis, you know, to Europe, but also in other places as well. I mean, even here to some extent, I would come back and cover that. And one of the things I always thought about is that when you were doing these like short news pieces at the time, I thought there's so much history behind this that doesn't even, you know, this person's life gets boiled down to like two or three sentences in an article. And that made me want to explore more like narrative nonfiction stuff on the same topic. So, you know, that was part of the motivation for why I started covering or writing books rather in that same space, because I felt like, look, there's a million things that happen that lead this person to this point, let's say like when they're crossing a border or crossing the sea, or, you know, or even like in the case of the book I wrote about Greece, like about to be attacked. You know, you know, I mean, people leave their homes for all sorts of different reasons. So I like that idea of there being this history behind everything that, you know, necessarily sometimes gets kind of lobbed off when we tell those stories was something that I carried a lot of, or I carried with me for a long time and tried to start doing more of, you know. And insofar as it relates to fiction writing, you know, I moved to Plano in 1996, and that was the year, or right around the time, that there was this huge panic over suburban heroin crisis. And that was not something that was unique to that place at all, really. I mean, it was something that was happening in communities all over the country. But I remember there was a magazine title that said, I remember seeing it at the grocery store with my mom while we were in line. And it said something like Texas heroin massacre. And I thought, wow, like all the history that goes into that led this person to this point where they overdosed or died, or their family, you know, is now like grieving them. And it just gets boiled down to this sensational three words, you know? And so I wanted to dig around in that space in the fiction. I don't know if I've done a good job at it or done it justice, but what I can say is, like, I was for the first time not writing, nonfiction or journalism. I felt like I really had a chance to not worry so much about what it was and to worry a lot more and explore a lot more how it felt. And that was what I hoped to do with this.
Well, I always think about the idea of fiction as being truer than the truth. You know, like, as a writer, you can really bring to the fore, in, as happens in, you know, in certain places in the stories, in pretty unflinching ways, like very raw, very realistically drawn characters. And you mentioned Plano. You know, I started to do a little bit of research while I was reading your stories about this heroin epidemic in the mid-90s up there in Plano and in the Denton area too. I mean, it was an epidemic. That is no exaggeration, mm-hmm. an indiscriminate thing. So I started to wonder what it was that you were, and you kind of answered the question, but I wonder if you can maybe expand on it a little bit, what you were trying to underscore here. I read some New York Times articles, for instance, that described nice kids from good families, right? Nice kids, good families, succumbing to the ravages of the epidemic, and basically, you know, according to these articles, transforming them into monsters. And you use that word too in the story, the idea of a kind of just not quite the same human being. So they're very challenging things to read about in a newspaper, in a magazine, but in fiction, I want to say it's a kind of a different experience to have somebody telling you the truest truths about somebody, maybe in an imagined space, maybe an imagined person, but it's so grounded in reality, obviously. What do you say to people who maybe aren't used to reading fiction about these sorts of things?
Well, I mean, it certainly might not be for everyone. That's a tough question. I think that part of what drew me to writing these stories too, because really only like one or two of them take place in the immediate aftermath of that 1996 period, which, I mean, you're absolutely right. It wasn't an epidemic. But I think that part of what bothered me about that is there was kind of this baked in assumption that like this shouldn't happen here, as if it should happen anywhere or would be okay that it could happen anywhere.
Yeah.
But you know, I mean, I was only like 10 years old when that was going on. 8-9 years later, when we were all coming out of high school, I mean, it was still happening in a lot of ways, but there wasn't nearly as much, there was almost no discussion about it at all. So I thought about that a lot too. Like, I mean, it was just a strange thing to me that it had mattered so much at one point, and then it was, I don't know, maybe a given, you know? Mm-hmm. Maybe it was assumed that that was just kind of normal now, like teenagers do heroin, you know, which is a terrible thing to take as, you know, just a fact of life. But I think that that's kind of what happened. And of course, if anybody doesn't like reading about that kind of stuff, you know, I mean, totally understandable. I don't know that I necessarily loved writing about it all the time, but these were the stories that kind of, you know, that stuck with me. And for some reason, I felt like I had to get through them. And I had an abnormally long gestation period, you know, I guess about 17 or 18 years had passed, you know, since I left home, that I really started writing stories about that period. And of course, they're all fictional. And, but, you know, there's a lot of emotional biography there.
Oh, that's such an interesting way of putting it. I was wondering about that, too. You know, because you have, you also have young narrators, young protagonists, and this kind of first-person point of view, you know, the whole Bildungsroman, right? The young coming-of-age narrator. I'm thinking about a story like General Holy War, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which, small masterpiece, let me just say. It's just a story that really, I don't know why, it really affected me. There's this very interesting thing that the narrator does with like this kind of synecdoche, like this sort of naming the characters according to like the cigarettes that they smoke. And it's just, there's something about this young character that I don't know that I'm looking at and I'm thinking there's something here. I mean, you say emotional biography, but leaving all that aside, the idea of emotion and the way it can bubble up, the way it can surface in a story that is very unsanitized, unflinching, very realistically drawn, very gritty, and very honest. And, you know, these are the kinds of things I think sometimes that this is another thing that people don't want to face. They don't want to admit the problem of something like teenagers do drugs, like teenagers do meth, teenagers do heroin. But also, they don't want to talk about poverty. They don't want to face what the effects of abject poverty and a lack of opportunity can do to people, a lot of people in the United States. And I think sometimes that poverty can seem very surreal to people who just will not consider what it's like out there for so many people. And I feel like in a story like this one, where granted, this young character's mother, you know, can take him to Walmart and buy him a toy, and she's trying to, you know, pay the bills, but they are steeped in poverty in this particular trailer park where they live and in this particular segment of society. So I think sometimes, you know, when people throw words like gritty and realistic and those kinds of things around, they're really talking about a kind of a subculture that they don't want to face, or that's, you know, an inconvenience. And I don't know, I feel like your stories shine a light on some of these other class issues. I mean, people from well-to-do families can do a lot of drugs and are part of this epidemic too, but I'm thinking also in terms of like the lack of opportunity, that all on its own, but then a lack of resources. And then also to go with that, you know, this kind of brand of masculinity that this young person is surrounded by too, and the thing that his father did to his arm and et cetera. There's just something for me within these pages that is also about that, that I think sometimes, you know, classic works of literature that have stood the test of time were about people steeped in poverty, you know, and they surface and they rise to the top and they're carried over for generations and generations and will be. And there's a reason for that, because I feel like even though people maybe don't want to face it or look at it, it's always going to be there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The, you know, one part, I mean, that story was one that I worked on and worked on and worked on, and it got a lot of rejections along the way. And there were times when I thought it just didn't, it wasn't right. And I think for quite a bit of time it was in the third person, but it wasn't until I found the right balance of the voice that I felt like I could even really write out the whole story. And that's because I feel like that narrator is, he's smarter than one would assume. But you also can't, you know, I had to find his voice, like just smart enough to where it wasn't too much. And that story, and I think a lot of other ones in this book, and I mean, I don't think about this while I'm writing, but later I thought about it some, and I thought that's really about the way boys are taught to treat and mistreat one another. I mean, that kid really has no friend, and the only men in his life, like Marlboro Reds, as you mentioned, like, you know, he calls them by the type of cigarettes they smoke. I mean, there's no sort of meaningful affection. And I think that that's something that is heightened whenever you don't have money. You know, there's like, I was talking about this last night at a talk. I think that boys are, you know, there's a kind of like baked in competitiveness and almost like a baked in hint of violence at all times. And the way like boys are, a lot of young boys are taught to carry out their friendships with one another. And I think I had just enough of that myself growing up, but also just enough of good quality friendships that were really affectionate with other guys. And, you know, I was talking to my friend about this last night. I said, I feel really lucky that I'm even able to kind of put my finger on this. And I think it's only because later in life I had, you know, male friendships where every time we got off the phone, we said, I love you or I miss you, you know? And that was something that I think really helped me kind of be able to understand that a little bit more. And so like in this story, you know, every male in the story, from the boys in the trailer park to his mother's boyfriend, are threats, you know. And I think that we're kind of taught in this country, especially as young men, that there is a level of threat to every other, you know, dynamic with every other male around you, even if they're your friend.
Yeah, I see that the way they talk to each other and the things they yell at each other, like in yeah. some of the early stories I'm thinking about.
Competing with swear words.
Yeah,
with the competing with swear words thing, yeah. too. I mean, I think that also like plays exactly into what you're talking about with this type of masculinity, because the kid that's better at swear words is the one whose dad is still around, you know, meaning that he inherits all of that from another man in his life.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, yeah, I think that, you know, long and short of it, I think, like, boys are really taught to mistreat one another from a young age. And that's a shame.
Yeah. I'm looking at this as, you know, this collection of stories. Stories are my absolute favorite thing to read. I love everything. I read everything. But short stories, that's where I go all the time for my reading. But I think in terms with this collection, too, of the idea of mystery, like a lot of the stories that I really love, they have a lot of question marks, because we do. Characters are always flawed because we are. A lot of them are doing the best that they can, and they fall short, and sometimes they fall short because they're not trying so hard for whatever reason. And that's real to me. And that's a mystery to me. The idea of mystery in a short story, it's an inherent part of the short story. It has to be, you know. I used to teach English, and my students would tell me how much they hated to read stories because they wanted a tidy ending. They didn't want anything open-ended. They didn't want question marks. But, I would try to convince them, no, the question marks, that's where we are. That's where we always are, every day. You know, we get up and we try it again, and we try to figure it out again. So the idea of mystery in here around, how can a mother do that? How can people subsist this way? There are plenty of resources out there. Why can't people make their way? And those are not very good questions for these kinds of situations that your characters are in. But there's more to their story than just what they don't have, what they lack, what they haven't mm-hmm. figured out. And they are just also very human. There's a hard one, tenderness. I don't know if that's the right word. So I wouldn't want listeners of this episode of the podcast to be thinking, oh, it's all this very rough stuff. I don't know if I want to read that. No, there's still a mystery to these characters. There's still a tenderness. There's still a humanity. And there's still resonance, you know. And you know this as a journalist and a writer of nonfiction, this idea that the more specific the detail is, the more universally appreciated it's going to be. So man, talk about the more specific the detail is and what polar opposites I am to some of these characters. And yet, somewhere in there, there's a connection that I make, because I see something that is this same mystery. I don't know if I'm making this clear, but you know, all stories are about loss, right? Frank O'Connor said, all stories are about loss. And every time we think we've filled some gaping hole in our lives, there's another one. And we fill that one, and it's at the expense of another one that we've created in our own space, in our own world. And these stories work in that same way. You know, the subject matter just happens to be very different from maybe what people are used to reading. But these stories are also now in this sort of tremendous pantheon alongside somebody like Breece DJ Pancake, right? Or Dennis Johnson. I've read the comparisons. As a lover of short stories, I have to say, I see that. I understand the comparisons. And congratulations to you for the comparisons.
Thank you. Thank you. Of course, I didn't make the comparisons myself.
No, you didn't. No, you didn't. But, you know, I think that that it's there. And, you know, when you talk about the gestation period of your stories and how you've spent so many years doing a different kind of writing and in another kind of space, I wonder, what's it like to walk into the space of being a story writer now, a fiction writer, a story writer? Has it been easy for you?
Oh, no, not at all. I think writing fiction is really, really difficult. I think it's more difficult than journalism or nonfiction, at least in my experience. And, you know, there's just one thing you can't do in nonfiction when you're writing about other people that you absolutely have to do in fiction, and that's get inside someone's head. But that was also what attracted me to going back. I mean, I wanted to write fiction initially, you know, I don't know, 20 years ago, but I had never been anywhere. And journalism kind of just offered me the opportunity. I had never traveled anywhere. I hadn't even ever really left the country. And journalism sort of offered me that opportunity. So I took it. And I think when you work in like hard news for a while, it can really change the way you write. Not for the better. But you are taught to really search for the most detail that you can find. And that was a good tool to carry over. But then switching back to this, like, I mean, starting to write fiction again, or trying in like 2018 or so, after, you know, almost 8 or 9 years of just doing journalism, was really, really challenging for me, you know, and I don't think I'm a natural at all. And there's some stories in this book. There's one story that had around 100 rejections. It's called Screaming East on I-10.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know why I kept trying. I mean, I probably shouldn't have, but I'm glad I did.
Me too.
I'm glad that after like a 100 no's, it found somewhere to reside and it ended up in this book. I think you just keep at it and keep going. And for me, there's something in all the stories, and you kind of mentioned this and what you were just saying before, something that I think everyone can relate to, no matter what the circumstances is, that these characters are convinced that they have absolutely no control over their own lives and what happens. And yet they feel like some kind of almost robotic need to continue to try to leave where they are or to change their situation. And I think everybody has been there. I know that when I'm in the most selfish part of my brain, I feel absolutely put upon by the universe. I feel like I have zero control over the circumstances around me, and that everything is almost deterministic. And I don't know who hasn't felt that, you know? And you convince yourself, if I could only leave, or if I could only change this. And this, in the case of these stories, I think it's often leaving. If I could only leave, then, you know, things would be better. But the few people who leave find that it's not so simple. And just like we all do, you know, when we convince ourselves that if we could only change one or two things, everything would be fine. You find out that actually your past really, really doesn't want to let you go so easily.
Patrick Strickland, thank you so much. I feel so honored to get to talk to you about A History of Heartache. Thank you so much for talking to me today.
Oh, are you kidding? I'm so grateful. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Patrick Strickland is the author of the story collection, A History of Heartache. It's published by Melville House. This has been Book Public from Texas Public Radio. Jacob Rosati composed our theme music. Dan Katz is Texas Public Radio's news director. I'm Yvette Benavides.